Yesterday the Gemara gave us a little lesson in chemistry, and it told us that if we wanted to be able to tell the difference between real tcheles and faux tcheles, there are two different chemical tests that we can perform. The first one the Gemara told us was that if you took alum and together with fenugreek water as well as mei raglayim, 40-day-old mei raglayim, and you take the three of them and you mix them together, and then you put the string of tcheles into that mixture, if the tcheles retains its appearance after being soaked in that mixture, so then you know it's genuine tcheles. But if the tcheles somehow splits and it splits up into two different colors under the influence of this mixture, so then you know that it's not good tcheles. The Gemara gave us a second chemical test. It said if you take sourdough that's made out of barley flour and you bake a string of tcheles inside of that dough, so if when you take it out of the oven the string of tcheles looks nicer, so then you know that it's genuine tcheles. But if this baking process causes the tcheles string to look not as nice, it diminishes its aesthetic appeal, so then you know that the tcheles is fake. The question arises, what happens when the results of these two chemical tests conflict with one another? What happens if the results conflict with one another? What happens if you put the string of tcheles into the alum with the fenugreek and the mei raglayim, and it turns out that the colors remain the same, but then you bake it in the sourdough and it diminishes its aesthetic appeal, or vice versa? What if you bake it in the sourdough and it begins to look nicer, but when you put it into this mixture of fenugreek and alum, and so then it splits, the appearance doesn't remain uniform, but rather splits into a deeper and a lighter blue. So what are you supposed to do under those circumstances? Now, so one possibility is that you didn't do the test properly, and that means that you have to redo, right? One of the tests, one of them was not administered properly. There should be a second possibility, a third two other possibilities. Then you just run a greater risk that the one test that you do is not going to be done properly.
Either one or the other. They used to do this way, another person used to do it the other way.
No, but the problem is, if these tests, right, are meant to identify the genuine tcheles, then it should be impossible for the results of the tests to be in conflict with one another. It's a different story.
You shouldn't go. You go to one. Same thing. This. Go to one test.
I was just thinking.
It's a different. It's a different story. There definitely are circumstances when it's mutter to go to two rabbanim. But then what's supposed to happen is you're supposed to tell the second rabbi. I asked the first rabbi already. This is the answer that he gave me. No. So then if the second rabbi disagrees, he's supposed to call up the first rabbi, they'll have a discussion about it, and then whatever the conclusion is, they'll tell you what the conclusion is at the end of the day. That's the way, I mean, there's no problem getting a second opinion, right, in Psak Halacha, as long as you're not the one who's going to determine which opinion to follow. You're bound by the first opinion. You can ask a second rabbi a second opinion, in as much as he disagrees with the first rabbi, he'll call up the first rabbi, try to convince the first rabbi. You're bound by the first psak that you get, but you're allowed to ask a second rabbi for his opinion, and then have him discuss it with the first rabbi.
Just that you have a rabbi who specializes in dummy, right?
There are. So again, we have this conflict. The Gemara tells us, and we're on the eighth line over here in the Gemara, and the Gemara tells us, Daf Mem Gimel Amud Aleph. It says there was a fellow who was named Sir from Mashki, and Sir of Mashki, Marmi Mashki, Aisi Techelta Bishani de Rav Achai. He brought a string of tcheles during the years of Rav Achai. Rav Achai was one of the later Amuraim, maybe probably not the same Rav Achai who was a Gaon, but one of the later Amuraim, and Badkua, but Rav Yitzchak, Breed Rav Yehuda, they checked it with that first test, the one that was suggested by Rav Yitzchak, the one with the alum and the fenugreek water, etc. And what happened that, as a result of that test? The ishtani lemalyusa. Sorry, this was the... It turned better. They baked it in the sourdough, and the appearance, the blue, became just even more appealing. So they determined, based on that test, that it was genuine treles. But then, savar... So it split. The colors split. There was a it split. It wasn't uniform anymore. There was a lighter blue. There was a darker blue. And so they thought that it's not treles. Savar. So then, what did they do? They did the second test.
Today's time, you have scientific tests, which is much more accurate. If we have the same test tomorrow, can you read it?
What are you testing for nowadays?
Because you can test a fiber, exactly, so we can test a fiber hundreds of years ago, it's exactly the same fiber or not.
But we don't know whether, we don't have treles from hundreds of years ago. If you have treles, then maybe you could identify it chemically. Right. We'll get to a problem with that in a second. But let's so they tested it with the second test. They baked it in the sourdough. The ishtani lemalyusa came out looking more appealing. So the two tests, the results of the two tests were in conflict. So savar lemifsala, they thought to be posel. In other words, they figured that maybe it needs to pass both tests in order to be genuine treles. And if it fails one of the two tests, so then it's not going to be treles. So they thought to be posalit. Now this assumption on its own is already a little bit of a difficult assumption. Because is there one type of treles or are there two types of treles?
Only one.
If there's only one type of treles, how can it be that sometimes the treles will fail one test and sometimes the treles will pass the same test? We're talking about the same treles, right? No. We're telling us that you need both of these tests. One of them alone is not enough, right? Because sometimes the treles will fail one of the tests, and that's where the other test will...
Because it's not the real McCoy. It's not the real Kala. It's a Kala Elon. That's why it's a Kala.
Okay, so 1 second. So you want to say there's two types of Kla Elon. There's one type of Kla Elon which can mimic treles on one test, but it can't mimic treles on the other test. And there's a second type of Kla Elon which can mimic treles on the second test, but not mimic treles on the first test. And so therefore, in order to determine whether it's genuine treles, you have to give both tests, because there's no type of Kla Elon which can pass both of the tests. And that's why you're saying that I need both tests, because there's two types of Kla Elon, two different types of dyes that simulate treles, and each of them can pass one of the two tests. So you need to administer both tests in order to determine that it's genuine treles. Okay, so that's, I guess, why that's why they thought that this particular dye was not treles, because it failed one of the tests. However, the Gemara said that's not the case.
If it failed the test, then they should know right away that it's not treles.
Did it fail the first test or the second test? It failed the first test, right?
No, the first test, that's it, you don't go far.
So it must be that they were trying to test whether the tests are accurate. Right, they were testing the test more than they were testing the treles. Right, and they were troubled because initially they thought, right, meaning when they first approached the sogya, they thought that these two tests were independent of one another. And so then they were troubled by the fact that the results yielded a discrepancy. And so then they said, well, maybe they're not independent of one another, but the tests need to be used together to determine the treles. However, Amar Luhu Rav Achai said to them, Ella, but rather ha lo tcheltahi velo kla ilanhi. Right, this doesn't. It's like a if the first test determined that it was tcheles, the second test determined that it was kla ilan. Rabbi Achai seems to be assuming that there's only one type of kla ilan, and so therefore, if it's either tcheles or kla ilan, the first test says it's tcheles, second test says it's kla ilan. So there's no way out anymore. You can't say that it's a different type of kla ilan that's able to pass one of the tests. Rabbi Chai seemed to have a tradition. There's only one type of kla ilan. In other words, if something has a color of treles, it can only one of two things. It can only be treles or kla ilan. It cannot be something else. It's a little bit hard. The Rambam says there's a third type of dye that can simulate kla ilan. But leaving that aside, Rabbi Chai says, so it can't be a different type of kla'ilon that's able to pass one of the tests. And therefore, Rabbi Chai said, Ella, So ha lo tchelta hiva lo kla ilani, it's neither tchelas nor kla ilan. What is it? Can't be anything else. Ela shmamina, says Rav Achai, we can infer from the results of the test that shmu asa ahadadi itmar. It's not that it needs to pass both tests in order to be tchelas, but rather it needs to pass either of the tests in order to be tchelas. So genuine tchelas is a die that can pass either the first test or the second test. And the Gemara explains even further. It says, "Heicha de bedachna b'derav Yitzchak b'ed Rav Yehuda. Lo ifrat chazusi k'sheira. You do the first test, and the color remains uniform. You don't need to do a second test. It's kosher. Ifrat chazusi. If the color ceases to remain uniform, if it splits into a darker and a lighter shade, then badkina la b'derav Ada b'chamira rachsa. Then we bake it into that sourdough. If it's ishtani l'mal yusa." It's kshera, even though it failed the first test, if it passes the second test, it's going to be kosher. But if it's like Usa, if it fails both the first test and the second test, so then it's going to be pasul. We got a corroboration.
It needs to pass just one test to be valid, but it needs to fail both tests in order to not be valid.
Exactly. And in Shalchu Mitam, we got a letter from Eretz Yisrael, Mehasam, from over there. That's a generic reference to Eretz Yisrael. Shmu Asa Ahadadi Itmar, that indeed, right, these two tests were independent of one another, and that they're really testing. Kla'ilan fails both tests. Tcheles will pass either one or the other, even if it fails the second. Now, I think that the simplest explanation is that the reason that Tcheles might fail one of the tests is because either the test was administered improperly or because the results were interpreted improperly. And so we'll say that the likelihood of administering or interpreting the results improperly is higher when it comes to treles than when it comes... So you did the test. Really, one test already should be enough, but we're worried about misinterpreting the results, so we say do the second test. I think we don't want to say that there's two types of tcheles, right? We don't want to say. There's one type of tcheles, and the concern here is that the results will be misinterpreted. That sound reasonable?
Scientifically speaking, though, it's not really valid.
Why is it not valid?
For starters, because with one of the tests consisting of two parts, neither one of the two parts is a constant, so how could you use it to verify anything?
Mm-hmm. Meaning, where did these tests come from, you want to know? Meaning that, let's say we had a tradition for Moshe Rabbeinu about this is tcheles. Right. And so we took all those things from Moshe Rabbeinu and we tested it out, and we discovered that sometimes it failed the one and passed the other, sometimes it passed the other and failed the one. But that the kla'ila and the fake tcheles, it always failed both.
In order for a test to be a test, it needs some kind of standard that has to pass. There's no standard here.
What do you mean there's no standard?
No, like with one of the tests consisting of two parts is saying that it seems to me that you can't use one part of the same test in order to validate that the other part of the same test.
Because that's not what we're doing, though. We have a tradition.
Based on some kind of standard, which is consistent, it's worthless.
Okay, so let me address that. This was the next thing that I wanted to point out. So yesterday afternoon, I was going through a couple of the articles about the Murex, what they say is tcheles nowadays. And there's a lot of very interesting things that they say about it. I'm hoping for those of you who join us on Erev Shabbos to talk about that tomorrow. I'm not going to have source sheets, but that's what I hope to talk about. Mir Tashem, 10 o'clock at Aruch Chaim, the balcony. So that's where we're going to talk a little bit more about this Murex, I forget, I don't even know how it's pronounced. Right? But we're going to talk about the identity of Tcheles nowadays, but there's something very interesting, an argument that's made by a Rabbi Shaul Weingart in the Truman Journal. And he basically makes the following argument. He says that if you go through the Gemaras and the Midrashim and where they refer to Tcheles, you'll discover, he says, that there's like 10 or 12 different descriptions that Chazal give us that help us determine what the real Tcheles is. He says, however, those descriptions can be classified into two categories. There's one description, which is like a very, very firm description. Like, we know, right, that if it matches this description, it's genuine Tcheles. And then he says there's a second type of characteristic, which is a little bit more ambiguous. And therefore, he says, if you determine based on the very clear characteristics that this is genuine Tcheles, you have to re-evaluate or reinterpret, right, all of the other characteristics so that it fits with this. So he wants to identify, Rabbi Weingart wants to identify, he says there's two main characteristics which are impossible to mistake. And he says, if you can determine that something is Tcheles based on those two characteristics, so then let's say you did this test and it failed both of these tests. He said, obviously, you're doing both of the tests wrong and you have to reinterpret to re-understand, right, what the tests mean. And I think that that's really what's happening in the Gemara, right? Meaning the Gemara had these two tests, and it thought, right, that if you need to pass both of them in order to be genuine Tcheles. But then we discover that something, right, or we thought that if you pass either of the tests, you're genuine Tcheles, and if you fail either of the tests, then you're Kla'ilon. But then the Gemara was faced with a conflict, because we took something which we knew, based on other criteria, to be genuine Tcheles. And it passed one test, but it failed the other one. And so we said, it can't be that our understanding is correct. We initially understood that if you pass, right, either of the tests, you're genuine Tcheles. If you fail either of the tests, you're genuine, you're Kla'ilon. But this passed one, which proved that it was Tcheles. It failed the other, which proved that it was Kla'ilon, and it can't be both. So therefore, the Gemara says, Rabbi Achai says, we have to reinterpret how we understood these tests. It can't mean what we thought it meant. It must be that it's not that you pass either of them, you're Tcheles, you fail either of them, you're Kla'ilon. It must be that if you pass either of them, you're Tcheles, and if you fail both of them, you're Kla'ilon. So the Gemara was revising, right, the interpretation of how to perform these tests, of the procedure for performing these tests, right, in light of some stronger characteristic, some stronger criterion, right, for determining that this is Tcheles. So that seems to be at least a little bit of a precedent, right, for Rabbi Weingart. Now, yes.
Okay. About 2 years ago, the Rabbi Glatzstein, like as part of his like the Wednesday night lecture series, he spent about 4 or 5 nights in talking about Tcheles. Mm-hmm. And did all kinds of research about, and like in the Middle East, in Europe, the different books and different tests they did, and the types of snails and the different types of fish that they thought that you might get it from, the processes they used in order to extract it from the different fish. And I think the bottom line is that nowadays that no such thing as the real Tcheles, he said.
You have to join us tomorrow. We'll discuss it more in depth. Right now, I'm just discussing the local as it connects to the Gemara that we're reading. But I hope to talk tomorrow. I don't think I've done that much research on it yet. But at least it'll be...
They sell
Tcheles. You can get it out of Yerushalayim too. You can get it here in New York. Yeah. It's very, yeah, it is more expensive than regular tzitzis. Yeah. So that's Rabbi Weingart's argument. He says that this test, whether or not the Tcheles passes this test, is immaterial because it passes the other tests that he says are more clear. And if it passes the other tests, then we just have to re-understand what this test is meant to do. Now, on the opposite side, we have Shlomo Miller, who is the Rosh Kollel and the Dayan in Toronto, a very, very big posek. So he makes the following argument. Now, yeah, I'm not familiar enough with the chemistry here, but he makes the following chemical assertion. He says that chemically, the tcheles that's used nowadays, right, to dye tzitzis strings that everyone accepts, right, as being the most likely tcheles, He says that Tcheles is chemically identical to the dye that comes from Kla Ilon. He said the two compounds are chemically identical to one another. And therefore, he says, how in the world are these two chemical tests going to discern between Tcheles and Kla Ilon? If two compounds are chemically identical, then they should react identically, right, to these tests. And therefore, he says, there is no way that we can reinterpret or re-understand these tests to bring them in line, right, with the most likely candidate for Tcheles nowadays, because if that most likely candidate is chemically identical to Kla Ilon, so then that it's got to be that they're going to react identically to both of these tests. Which process?
The same chemicals, which are used in different ways and different results. Different degrees of heat, the pressure maybe, it depends.
Because it's both aside from the chemical composition.
But he says it's the same makeup, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but it depends
on
the process also.
You have the same molecules. You're not talking about different...
When it comes to things, the process is important too, the way that you can cause it.
But what that would mean is, let's say, Kla Ilon is a plant. I think that they say it's a dye that's called indigo. Right? So if you have a plant, and the plant produces, right, the material for the indigo dye, right? And so why don't you process that the same way that you would have processed the Tcheles from the Murex, and then it'll be again identical chemically and mechanically, but it's not going to be Tcheles.
Maybe the temperature varies, maybe the time varies, maybe they use a catalyst to speed things along that they can't find traces of afterwards. You know,
Alan,
we don't know.
You know what synthetics are? Huh? Synthetics.
Right.
You can have the same compound, either natural or synthetic. Their molecules are identical.
Right.
That's it. That's what he's saying.
And not clear. Tcheles indigo would be Kla Ilon. Tcheles needs to come from the Chila zone.
I'm not involved in where it comes from. We are involved now by the color of this particular.
No, not by the color, by the origin. By the origin, yeah.
We're not eating it. It's a color you're looking at. You have to look at it. And remember, it's like the ocean. The ocean is like...
But it says psil tchelet. It says psil tchelet. And tchelet is one of those words like totafot that we have a tradition that it means, right, a compound that comes, right, from the chila zone.
My argument is, it doesn't matter where it comes from. You have to look at the Tchelet. The Tchelet reminds you of the sea. The sea reminds you of the sky. And the sky is supposed to remind you of Kisei HaKavod. We have to look at the color to remind us of Kisei HaKavod. From A to Z, right? What difference does it make where it comes from? If I today, in 2016, have a computer that can break down the molecular function of this color and produce a million of them together, what do I care if it comes from the sea, or comes from a plant, or comes from my Woodsville?
Robot checks the cat.
I don't understand. What's the difference? I'm looking at the color. I'm not eating it. I'm looking at the color. The color is identical to the one that comes from the sea, or comes from the plant, or comes from any other animal out there.
So when we talked about the Tamei mitzvot, we said that sometimes the parameters, right, of the mitzvot are a little bit more broader, a little bit more narrow than just the ta'am. So you're telling me the ta'am of tzitzit, and remember, keep in mind that at the beginning of the series we analyzed that there's more than one reason for tzitzit. It's more than just to remind us of all these things. But even leaving that aside, right, so you're saying if this is the only reason for tzitzit, to remind us of the Kisei HaKavod, right, so then why can't anything that reminds us of the Kisei HaKavod work? Right, and the answer might be that very often the details of the law, right, are sometimes a little bit different than you would think based on the reason for the law. Now, why is that? So, you know, some people like the Arizal would tell you that based on Kabbalah, that there are certain metaphysical characteristics that the Tcheles is invested with, which perhaps only come when the Tcheles is derived from a certain source. And others might tell you that the mitzvah is, you know, sometimes there's things about the mitzvah that are beyond our understanding, but that we nonetheless need to conform with in order to fulfill the mitzvah properly. So you're right, if all that we cared about was a tam mitzvah, so then perhaps any blue dye would be sufficient, but there may be more than that. That said, I have to say that the Drishat Tzion, right, the Drishat Tzion, the Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, right, and he wanted to restart the Avodat HaKarbanos, he wanted to start the Karbanos again, to go to Eretz Yisrael, to Har HaBayis, and to bring Karbanos even without the Beis HaMikdash. One of the difficulties that he had is that you need the Big Day Kahuna in order to bring Karbanos. Kohen is not wearing a Big Day Kahuna, cannot bring Karbanos. And in order to make Big Day Kahuna, you need Tcheles. So he wrote a little bit about Tcheles and renewing the Tcheles. And his solution was exactly what you said. He wanted to infer from the Rambam that at the very least the Tcheles for Big Day Kahuna could be any blue dye that will retain its color no matter what happens to it. Right? But that was a very, very controversial point. Right, the Sefer Avodat Tama, among others, right, who took great issue with the Drishat Tzion, wrote a long essay saying the Drishat Tzion misinterpreted the Rambam. There is indeed one line in the Rambam that may or could be read as suggesting that any blue dye that retains its color is Tcheles, right? But there are multiple other lines that give you a very different impression about what the Rambam's opinion is. And so that became a very big controversy. Well, we can't just take any blue dye and use it for tcheles. There are certain sources that must be, you know, that must be utilized. There are certain procedures that must be followed. And in the absence of those, just because we're able to come up with some sort of a permanent blue dye, that doesn't mean that we can renew the Big Day Kahuna. Yes, two more questions and that's it. Yes.
That would be the only problem with the carbonus. How about Tahara? How about Chazuya for Adoma? Lots
of things. Homohotra b'tzibur, right? All of those, the Drishat Tzion addressed all of them. The Avodat Tama and many other Svarim responded to the Drishat Tzion about all of them. So it's a big, big discussion. Yes?
Was Rabbi Miller's contention that the Chelos in the old days were chemically different than
Kla'ilon? Because otherwise, meaning if the Tcheles will react one way to these tests, the Kla'ilon will react a different way to these tests, so then obviously there's some difference between them. Right? And the difference presumably is a chemical difference if they're reacting differently to chemical tests. So he says, therefore, any Tcheles compound which is chemically identical to Kla'ilon cannot be the genuine Tcheles. That's his argument. So,
Rabbi, do you ever see Tchelet in the snail when Tchelet comes up? Do you ever see it?
I've never seen it, no.
In Israel. Yeah, I did. It was a Frum archaeologist who showed us. He said, this is the coat of Tchelet.
And you believe it?
Oh, yes.
Okay, good.
The man who was talking, he was dying.
It's all right.
It was his profession. Why shouldn't I believe it?
Okay. Mirtashem tomorrow, part of the discussion is the admissibility of archaeological evidence into halacha. That's a big part of the discussion. How admissible, or when is archaeological evidence admissible, right, in the court of halacha? So we'll go to that. Mirtashem, that's tomorrow's topic. So let's move onwards now. The Gemara tells us Rabbi Mani, Dieg Vizavin Kichumri Masnita, that he used to be very careful when he purchased a pair of Tcheles to follow all the Chumras of the Braisos. In other words, the Braisa at the bottom of Membeis Amud Beis told us that you should only purchase Tcheles from a Mumcha, from a learned expert. So he was very careful to only purchase Tcheles from a learned expert. And, right, in addition to that, just in case, the expert might be an expert on the laws of Lishma, but he might not be a chemical expert about whether this Tcheles is genuine Tcheles or Kla'ilon. So Rabbi Mani used to dip the Tcheles into the alum fenugreek mixture, and he used to bake it in the barley sourdough, and he would make sure that it was absolutely Tcheles before he put it on. So then somebody told Rabbi Mani, Amar le Yahu Saba, there was an old man who told him, Hachi avod kamai de kamach. This is what the people who two generations before you used to do. The atzlach iskayu, and it was a skula. It was a skula for atzlacha in their asakim, in their businesses. So that was Rabbi Mani really got it right. What about if you don't have any Jewish people who are selling the tcheles and you want to buy tcheles over Amazon? Right? You're buying it, let's say, who knows, it's not necessarily from a Jewish seller. Let's say in the pre-Amazon days, you're living out, you know, wherever, and so the local purveyor of everything, right, he'll order it into his store, but he's not Jewish. Are you allowed to purchase tzitzis or tcheles from someone who's not Jewish? So the Gemara tells us...
Walmart. You go to Walmart, you get anything in Walmart.
Walmart?
Yes. So let's see, the Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, Halokeach talis mitzuyatzes min ashuk. A person who goes to the marketplace, he's not going to someone with whom he's personally familiar. He's just going out to the marketplace and buying a talis with tzitzis already on it. If it's Mi'Israel, if he's buying it from a Jew, Harehi b'chez kasa, that there's a presumption that it was manufactured in accordance with halacha. There's a chazaka that it's a halachically kosher talis, because most people who work with manufacturing talisos know what they're doing. And so even though there may be a couple of people who do it without knowing what they're doing, since most people who manufacture talisos know what they're doing, even if you're not buying it from a mumcha, there still is a presumption that it was manufactured properly. What about if you're buying it from a non-Jew? Mina ovid kochavim. If you're buying it from a non-Jew, if that non-Jew is a tagar, mina tagar, if you're buying it from a merchant who's got a reputation to uphold, and if he is discovered selling goods which are not quite as advertised, he's going to lose his license, or he'll lose his credibility in the eyes of his other customers. So then it is kshira. If he says, this is a kosher talis, you can trust him, because if you discover that it's not a kosher talis, it's going to ruin his business, and he would never risk that. However, if you're buying it from a private individual, min a hedyot, so then it's psula, because what does he have to lose by lying? So there's no, there aren't the same checks and balances to ensure that he'll give you honest advertising. So again, if the guy tells you it's kosher, it means he must have bought it from a Jew. He didn't make it himself. And even though they said, "Ein adam rashai limkor talis mitzuyatzes lo'ovid kochavim," person is not allowed to sell a talis with tzitzis to a guy. It's a violation of rabbinic legislation. The rabbi said it is forbidden for Jews to sell talisos with tzitzis on them to non-Jews. Actually, atir tzitzisel, you've got to untie the tzitzis before you sell it to the non-Jew. And so therefore you might think, if the non-Jew says, this is a kosher talis, I bought it from a Jew, chas v'chalila, no Jew would have transgressed, would have violated this rabbinic law to sell it to you. No, we assume that some Jew did violate the rabbinic law, because it's much more likely that a Jew violated the rabbinic law and sold a talis mitzuyatzes to a goy than it is that the goy manufactured it himself.
Wait a minute, this is a private goy or
a regular? No, a tagar.
A merchant.
A merchant.
Can it be said now?
Business is business. Don't touch.
Like in the case of the sister,
business is business.
They come and start to seal a package with the proper labeling. That store stuff doesn't matter. Says bond the Empire Chicken and Kifu, because it comes in package, and all they do is weigh it.
Yes, so the answer is, it's definitely fine if it comes in a package, but whoever sold the package to the guy is still in violation of that rabbinic legislation.
Right.
And we'll see why in a second. The concern was that, it's like, I remember I one time read a story about how somebody one time mugged a policeman, and all that he stole was the uniform. So why in the world would somebody steal a police uniform? Exactly. Because later on, that criminal used the uniform to impersonate a policeman, and he busted a guy out of prison with it. He masqueraded as a policeman, and then he showed up, and he was part of the convoy that was escorting the prisoner from one place to another, and he busted the guy out of prison with that stolen uniform. So we're a little bit nervous that tzitzis are like our uniform, and we're concerned that maybe the guy is going to impersonate, right, a Jew, and use that impersonation to do something which we would rather that he didn't do.
The terrorists in Israel do it.
Oh, exactly. Okay. So it still is a concern nowadays. So even though we said a person can't sell a talus with tzitzis to a guy, but if the guyish merchant has a talus with tzitzis, it's more likely that a Jew violated that law and sold it to him, and less likely that the guy manufactured it himself. Therefore, you can buy it from him and assume that the talus is kosher. Actually, it's still not a problem, you can assume. Now, why is it that we said not to? My timer, what's the reason that you can't sell a talus with tzitzis to a guy? So, Hacha Targimu in Bavel, they interpreted Mishum Zona, because the guy may dress up as a Jew in order to impress some Jewish lady, right? And then there's going to be a violation of Boel, right, Aramis, or the inverse of that. So he may use the talus, right, in order to get involved in a liaison with a Jewish lady. She would never go near him if she knew that he wasn't Jewish, but he'll disguise himself, and therefore he'll get her involved. The second interpretation, in Eretz Yisrael, they gave a different interpretation. And in Eretz Yisrael, they said, Rabbi Yehuda said, Shema yitlua yislaveh imo badarech, that may be that the guy and a Jew, they'll keep one another company on the road. They're going to be traveling companions. And the Jew will not know, right, that this person who's standing next to him is a rabid anti-Semite. Right? Right? So we're worried that an anti-Semite will purchase tzitzis, and then he'll go keeping the Jew company on the road. Oh, Lanzmann. And then when the Jew's not looking, he may harm him. So, Shema Yislaveh Imo Baderech V'Harganu. And then they'll end up, the concern is actually for murder. Like you said, a person dresses up as a Jew, they get entree, right, into places that they wouldn't get entree otherwise, and that endangers, right, all the other Jews who are in that place. Okay, so that basically brings to a conclusion this sugya about treles and about the certifications and the different, you know, it's best if you buy it from someone who you know and trust, that if you're buying it from a Jew and you see that there's a good hashkacha label from a good beis din, so then you're also good. But if you're not doing that, if you're buying it from a goyish merchant, you can still assume that since most people who manufacture tzitzis know what they're doing, you can assume that the tzitzis that you're buying are kosher. You're talking about nowadays or back when they had real treles?
No, nowadays.
Well, nowadays, so treles is just our best guess.
No, so then.
So back then, if I found something with treles,
And are you allowed to wear it? And wrong with wearing it, you don't know. So question one, is it a chazaka? Question two, could you wear it?
Right, so you, on the one hand, you might say it's the chazaka because most people who manufacture tzitzis, right, do it in a kosher way. On the other hand, there's also what's called a reyasa, because it could be that most tzitzis that people just drop on the floor, why do they drop it on the floor? Because there's some problem with it. So if you're buying it from a merchant, you're buying it even from a goyish merchant, you still have a presumption that it's a kosher pair of tzitzis. But if it's a pair of tzitzis that you found on the floor, sometimes we'll consider that a reyasa. Why people only drop things on the floor, they don't care about them. They think that there's something wrong with them. So maybe this is a defective pair of tzitzis. That's why it was on the floor. And so that might take away the chazaka. Laying in a shul, so then you could for sure presume that it's a kosher pair of tzitzis.
Do you equate chalazim with treles? Are they equated?
The treles needs to be manufactured from the blood of a chalazim. If it doesn't come from the blood of Achilazim, it's not kosher treles, except according to the Drishat Zion and according to Boaz. So that's part of the question. Tomorrow, Mirtz Hashem, will go into that at greater length. But at least what I've been able to find so far. So Rabbi Miller claims it can't be because the murex dye is chemically identical to the indigo dye that comes from a plant.
Is chemically.
That's what Rabbi Miller claims. I need somebody who has a chemical background to tell me whether that's...
I suffer cancer. I can get you or something.
Do you have a picture of a color?
It's a canvas.
You have a picture of a color, Elon?
He say indigo.
So do you have a picture of it? I just want to see what it looks like.
I mean, you can you can ask someone with a smartphone to get a picture of it on their phone.
What's color, Elon?
Indigo. So that's why Rabbi Miller claims that the Tchilas Tzedek is going to fail the test. He doesn't even have to do the test because it's going to fail. Rabbi Weingart will tell you that since the tests can be interpreted by meaning that the procedure for these tests, right, there's already machlokos between Rashi and Tosfos about what the procedure is and what the ingredients are. So basically he says if the Tchilas fails a test, it just means that we're administering the test wrong. And so there's no way, he says, that the tests nowadays can disprove the identity of the Tchilas, right, because if it doesn't pass the test, it just means that we're doing it wrong. Right, and that's what Rabbi Chai did. He said, it didn't pass both tests. It means that we must have misunderstood how the tests are meant to be interpreted. Okay, so we're ready to begin the next sugya. The next sugya is going to be a little bit of a quick question and answer, and it has to do with a number of important questions. Question number one: whether women are obligated to wear tzitzis or not. Now, we already know anybody here whose daughters wear tzitzis. You bought tzitzis for your daughter when she was 3 years old. No, so we paskin that women do not need to wear tzitzis. Right, but it's perhaps not surprising that this was a matter of controversy about 1700 years ago, perhaps a little bit longer than that. And the rabbis only arrived at a consensus sometime between then and now. And so we're going to look at the initial controversy, and perhaps we'll spend a little bit of time seeing how the consensus emerged and what were the difficulties with the opinion that was ultimately rejected. In the course of that, we'll also talk about the question about tzitzis at night, wearing tzitzis at night, because we know that women are obligated in all timeless mitzvos. And so if the mitzvah is a 24/7 mitzvah, or if a mitzvah has no association with cycles of time, so then a woman will be obligated. If the mitzvah is a time-bound mitzvah, right, it depends on the cycles of time, so then a woman will be exempt. And so in order to understand the controversy over whether women are obligated or exempt, we also have to understand whether tzitzis is a time-bound mitzvah, which would make women exempt, or whether tzitzis is a timeless mitzvah, which make women obligated. And for those of you who were with us last month on Erev Shabbos, we spoke about this once, so we're not going to go into all of the details of it, but let's focus now on the back and forth, right, in the Gemara. So the Gemara says... Yeah, so the question...
Will you marry one of them? Why do you bring that up?
They do a lot of things.
The women as a coat, some of the women come.
Make a profit.
And children also.
Exactly.
Actually, there may be a problem with tzitzis that has nothing to do, it's possible, I mean, a woman could wear tzitzis, not wear tzitzis, because it's a beggar.
The talent they wear is a multicolored.
Right, and some people say, who was it who was telling me yesterday that there could be a problem of yuara? A person is not supposed to say, I'm holier than thou. So, So let's see it inside. Rabbi Yehuda, Rami Techelta, Le Prezuma de Inshi Bese. Rabbi Yehuda put tcheles onto the clothing of all the members of his household. He put tzitzis onto his wife's clothing. Umivarich called Safra, and every morning he would make a bracha list at Teif Batzitzis. So the Gemara is troubled. These two practices of Rabbi Yehuda seem to be in conflict with one another.
In other words, he made the bracha, not the wife.
His wife probably made the bracha too, but we don't know exactly what she did. Oh. Right? But Rabbi Yehuda, his talmidim sometimes, you know, saw him putting on his talis, and they saw him make the bracha. So the Gemara says these two practices seem to be in conflict with one another. Because on the one hand, by saying that his wife is obligated, that implies that it's a timeless mitzvah. right? That it's not bound by time. And so there's no cycles of being exempt from tzitzis, then obligated in tzitzis, then exempt from tzitzis, then obligated in tzitzis. Person who wears tzitzis for the whole week straight, right? It's not as if he's fulfilling seven mitzvos, one on Sunday, one on Monday, one on Tuesday, one on Wednesday, but rather he's fulfilling one long protracted mitzvah from the moment he puts it on until the moment that he takes it off. And consequently, since it's all one mitzvah, he shouldn't be making seven brachos on one mitzvah. He should be making one bracha on it. So the Gemara is troubled. The fact that Rabbi Yehuda made a bracha every single morning seems to imply that he holds that it's a new mitzvah, chadashim la bekarim, right? It's a new mitzvah every morning. That's why he's making a new bracha every morning. So if it's a new mitzvah every morning, that implies that it is bound by the cycles of time. But by the fact that he said his wife had to put on the tzitzis, it implies that it's not bound by the cycles of time. It's a timeless mitzvah. That's why he felt that his wife was obligated. The Gemara felt...
in the morning he puts it on, he has to make a bracha.
Okay, so maybe, so that might be the solution. Could be that the solution was, is that he used to change his talus every morning.
No, not change the talus.
You put on a new
talus. He puts and he puts on his nighttime
same
talus.
Talus.
But one second, if you have to wear tzitzis at night, the same way you have to wear tzitzis by day, so then why is he taking tzitzis off at night? Meaning if it's
because
a timeless mitzvah.
Because what he's wearing at night doesn't need it.
No, but Rabbi Yehuda says it's a timeless mitzvah. Timeless mitzvah means that it's just as obligatory by night as it is by day.
It's obligatory, but what he's putting on at night doesn't require tzitzis because it's a night garment that doesn't have four corners.
But so you're saying that maybe his pajamas didn't have four corners. So during the daytime, you're saying that the tailor, right, the only type of clothing you get is four-cornered clothing, and so he had tzitzis on his daytime clothing. The pajamas, they sell without four corners, and so he wasn't wearing tzitzis on his pajamas.
Not only that, it says uritematu, nighttime you don't see.
But that's only according to the way that we paskin. Rav Yehuda paskin, uritematu means that a blind person is exempt from tzitzis, but sighted people are obligated in tzitzis even at night. That's how Rav Yehuda is going to paskin. So the Gemara is troubled. The solution may indeed be, right, that Rav Yehuda had something else that he wore at night, and he would put on his daytime tzitzis anew every morning. That's why he made a bracha. Right now, the Gemara is not yet so familiar with Rabbi Yehuda's styles and dress patterns, and the assumption was that if Rabbi Yehuda holds that tzitzis are obligatory by night and by day, presumably he just kept on the same pair of tzitzis, right, by day and by night. A person takes a nap on Shabbos afternoon, right? So do they take off their tzitzis before they take a nap? I guess some people do, some people don't, right? But it's not unreasonable to say that a person will take a nap even wearing their tzitzis. Rabbi Yehuda held that tzitzis are obligatory by night, so why wouldn't a person who held that go to sleep in his tzitzis? So the assumption, the starting assumption is that Rabbi Yehuda is wearing his tzitzis to sleep, and that means he's waking up with those tzitzis. He never took the tzitzis off. It's not a new mitzvah every day anew, so then why is he making a new bracha? So that's the Gemara's problem. He says, midirami, from the fact that he placed the tzitzis on his wife's clothing, kasavar mitzvah saseh shalo asman gramahu. It must be that he holds that's a mitzvah saseh, which is not time-bound. It's timeless. So then, amai mevarich kol tzafra v'tzafra. Why does he make the bracha every morning if it's a timeless mitzvah? So then today's fulfillment of tzitzis is just a continuation of yesterday's fulfillment of tzitzis and doesn't require its own bracha. And the...
That's what the Gemara just answered. Next line. Okay. Yeah, you know the Gemara by heart.
Kerebi Desanya Tfilin calls man shamanichon as lo, every time that you put them on anew, mivarei chaleim, you make a new bracha on them, divrei Rebbe. So the Gemara is troubled. So why does it say then that Rabbi Yehuda would make a bracha every morning? Right? We should say, it should say he made a bracha sometimes multiple times every day. And right? Ihachi says the Gemara, if so, kol shaita nami. Right? He should make a bracha every hour, theoretically.
Every time he touches the tzitzis,
I don't know, touching the tzitzis. We don't make a bracha every time that we touch our tefillin, but every time we take them off and put them back on, so then we do make a bracha. So let's say he took a shower, l'kavod Shabbos. Right, and now he's coming out of the shower, he's putting on, right, in the tzitzis a new time. Showers are a little bit controversial, right? But not taking showers, but making a new bracha on tzitzis after the shower, right?
Hmm? I said a problem about taking. I don't understand what you're saying, Rabbi. I don't understand
You take a shower, right? And you're getting dressed again. You're putting on your tzitzis. Do you make a bracha? Do you make a bracha on the tzitzis, right, that you're putting on now again after your shower?
I understand, but why'd you say there's a problem taking a shower?
No, there's no problem taking a shower. The problem is that you run into an uncertainty about whether or not to make a bracha when you're putting the tzitzis back on after the shower.
That's interesting. Because with the palace, when you go to the bathroom, we'll come back.
You don't have
to. Right, but that's for two reasons. Again, Rabbi Arfi is pointing out that the person who takes off their talis in order to use a restroom then comes back and puts on the talis, so they're not going to make a new bracha. And there's two reasons that are given for that. One reason is because the break that a person takes to use the bathroom is a very short break. And so it doesn't mean that you're interrupting your concentration on the talis to a significant extent. So the break is so short that we can combine the talis wearing after you return with the talis wearing that you had before. We say it's almost as if it was never interrupted. Right. In addition to that, right, there's also the fact that you're still wearing the tzitzis. Right. A person wears the tzitzis even into the bathroom, even if they don't wear the talis. And so that also establishes a continuity between the initial wearing of the talis and the later wearing of the talis. Now, when it comes to showers, right, neither of those are necessarily the case. A shower very often takes longer than a quick trip to the bathroom, right? And in order to take a shower, unless you've got special waterproof tzitzis, right, you're probably going to be removing the talis katan as well, right? And so I think,
imagine so.
And so I'm never sure what to do when I come out of a shower. I'm never sure what to do. Should I say a new bracha on my tzitzis when I put them on, or should I not say a new bracha on the tzitzis when I put them on? So I think there's different solutions. Again, now I'm relying on what I remember from like 15 years ago when I went through this, right? But I think that there's a couple of solutions that are offered. So I think that some people say when you put on tzitzis in the morning, you should have in mind that the bracha should only cover you up until you take a shower. So that then you could almost
evaporate. Once you take it off, it evaporates.
Right, meaning that you haven't.
It's a new beginning.
Right. Now I'm not 100% sure why your intentions, right, about where the bracha should last until make a difference. But if I put on tzitzis and I'm not going to take a shower, and I have in mind that the bracha should last me until noon, and then at noontime I want to make a new bracha, I don't think that my intentions are going to work. So I have to check. I think that the Be'er Halacha said this far. I have to look at the Be'er Halacha again to see what he says and how he addresses that. But another solution might be to have two pairs of tzitzis. You'll have the pre-shower tzitzis and then the post-shower tzitzis. And for sure, if you're changing pairs, there's no continuity between the first pair and the second pair. So then you can definitely make a bracha, right, on the second pair. So I don't have two pairs of tzitzis for weekdays, but at least when I take my Shabbos shower, I know that I can make a new bracha, right, on the tzitzis that I'm putting on afterwards, because that's when I change from weekday tzitzis into Shabbos tzitzis, and I know that I'm for sure covered. I can make a bracha on that second pair. But Rabbi Yehuda, the Gemara says, he only made a bracha in the morning. He didn't make a bracha in the middle of the day. And the Gemara explains that the reason for this is because Rabbi Yehuda was an inish tzniya. He was a very modest, private person. And v'lo shari le leglime kula yoma. He would leave his clothing on the whole day. He would not take a shower in the middle of the day. And that's why the only time that he took his clothing off, right, was when he was changing into a new outfit for the day. That was the only time that he would be changing his clothing, taking off the previous day's clothing. The Gemara says, "Ma'ishna mitzafra." Right? Why is it that he did that every morning? Why didn't he do that every evening? And if he's changing once in that 24-hour period, why do that in the morning and not in the evening before bed? So he says, "Kimishani miksus laila liksus yom." That's when he would make the bracha, when he switched from his nighttime clothing to the daytime clothing. That is when he would make the bracha of his ateif bat tzitzis.
He did change into nighttime clothing.
Maybe it's like Mr. Amster said, that he didn't wear tzitzis at night. Even though he felt that it was obligatory, perhaps he didn't wear tzitzis at night.
Or he held like a rush or whatever. Tzitzis level was tzitzis.
Yeah, but you see, look at the Rashi. He had Meshani Mishk. Umeshani ki Meshani Miksut Laila Liksut Yom. Shne Talitot Mitsuyatzot Ayulo. Achat Leyom Vachat Lalaila. He did wear Talit. Sit it on at night.
So why didn't he make a bracha?
Maybe he'd make a bracha at night as well. Are you
he
right?
Didn't say that.
He doesn't say that, but...
No, so we have to figure that out. So that's an interest. That's an important question. I guess that we'll try to meditate on this question over Shabbos, and maybe we'll pick up with that on Monday, Mirtz Hashem. Mirtz Hashem, yes.